Welcome to this edition of Quest Point in the Mix. You know, recognizing all the possibilities associated with the solar industry is like putting together the pieces of one big puzzle. And one organization that has found a positive way to make a difference with clean, green energy is Beyond Solar. Beyond Solar's mission is to improve the educational, medical, economic, and well-being of individuals and communities in the developing world. They do this by providing solar-powered electricity. To do this, Beyond Solar has partnered with D-Light Design, Latrin manufacturer based in New Delhi, and South Orissa Volunteer Action, an NGO. An NGO stands for non-government organization focused on improving the livelihood of tribal villagers in the Koraput district in the eastern Indian state of Orissa. D-Light Designs Nova Solar Lantern provides up to 40 hours of solar-powered light on one solar charge. A 2-watt solar panel, a connecting wire, and a lantern that contains a battery, a charge controlling chip, and an LED light. The lantern has 4 brightness settings on a fully charged battery, and the light will last 12, 20, 40, or 200 hours in decreasing order of brightness. Beyond Solar was founded by Jeff Ocheski and Trevor Knopf, and they applied the concept of microcredit to the renewable energy sector to prove that the rural poor could afford the cost of solar-powered lighting systems. The avoided cost of kerosene, the most common source of energy, and the ability to extend productive working hours would provide income to pay for the lighting systems. Beyond Solar's objective was to complete a pilot project that demonstrates a sustainable and profitable model in the hopes that private entities such as microfinance institutions and technology manufacturers will see opportunity in this market and focus their efforts on large-scale distribution. With us today is Jeff Ocheski, who recently returned from India. Jeff, welcome home, and welcome to Quest Point in the Mix.
Thank you, Richard.
I was hoping that you'd be able to describe the locations that you visited, and I mean, I think most of us have heard of Mumbai and where the areas that you visited are in relationship to Mumbai.
First off, I want to say thank you for having me on. The areas that we focused on were in the state of Orissa, and if you look at the map of India from sort of a high level, the lower portion looks sort of like a triangle extending out into the Arabian and Indian Ocean.
Oh, okay.
Mumbai is on the west coast, about halfway down. And if you went due east and maybe a little bit north, you would towards the coast on the east side, you'd
okay.
come to the state of Orissa. And Koraput, the area that we worked out of, is in the southern region of Orissa, and it's right on the border of the state of Andhra Pradesh. From what we've been told, Orissa is one of the poorest states in the country. And we worked primarily with a group of people that are just commonly referred to as the tribal people. They have sort of maintained a very simple lifestyle, and they've not jumped on the sort of modernization and westernization. They look, dress, and speak very differently than just the average Indian person. They have their own language, their own customs, and SOVA, our NGO partner that you mentioned, works with the tribal people to basically just improve their livelihood through educational means, health initiatives, HIV awareness, which is a problem. When we got a hold of D-Light, they put us in contact with someone who knew someone at SOVA. So it was a little bit of a web that we finally ended up connecting with SOVA, and that's how we were able to do our project.
Well, your most recent trip, can you talk about that a little bit?
I just returned from India. It was a shorter trip because we had laid the groundwork in our inaugural trip in 2008. So 2008 was really the learning and the building of the partnerships, traveling around, figuring out what works and what does not work. We actually met with a larger NGO that's in a little bit north of Koraput in a city called Burhampur. And that NGO, the name is Graham Vikas, and they're a much, much larger organization, and you know, we went there and we found that we wanted to do something sort of quick and more of a pilot program. They didn't really have the resources to sort of just work with us on a one-on-one basis. They were talking about something really big, and you know, that would be great. But we found, practically speaking, Silva was able to give us sort of the attention that we needed. So, like I said, in 2008, we went and that's when we established the programs. We distributed our lights. We did all the interviews. This year, the trip that I just returned from, we went to the same region. We went to new villages, but we went to the same region and worked with Sovo. You know, they had seen the benefits of our inaugural program, so there wasn't as much of a, what I'm going to call, a convincing time period where we had to sell our organization and sell the product and sell the distribution method. Everyone knew it worked, so it was a lot quicker, a lot more economical.
I see.
And we were able to get more lights out to more villagers.
So it's kind of a follow-up and evaluation as well as a new introduction meeting.
We made it into the villages where we had visited on the first trip. You know, all of our sort of hypotheses were validated. All the benefits of the light were there. They'd saved money. They didn't have to buy kerosene. There were no fires in the village from kerosene lights. They were able to extend their working day. Mm. You know, everything that we've sort of expected to happen did, and then some. So it was great to go back to the villages and see the impact that just these very simple products make. What was great, though, is that, you know, we had a little bit of our pilot project had worked the previous year, so our fundraising efforts said, you know, we're going to go back here. We have a goal to reach almost twice as many villagers. And we had a little bit more credibility, so that was nice.
How many people are in these villages, or how many in each community that you, or the communities that you've worked with thus far?
You know, it was generally anywhere from 40 to maybe 80 or 100 households.
Oh, I see.
Each household would consist of typically of 3 to 4 people.
I see.
Not too many more had more than, or at least from what I saw, more than 2 or 3 kids. But on average, you know, 3 or 4 people. So they were definitely small, very very cohesive. You know, a lot of group decision making.
I'm curious, what sparked the interest that you and Trevor had in creating Beyond Solar? I mean, how did all this get started, and you know, what was your background?
Well, Trevor and I were both colleagues at a solar developer in Southern California. That's where we met. And we were both young, single guys, and we were always bouncing ideas off about, you know, business ideas, or and both kind of had a common interest in traveling. And to be honest, I don't even remember which one of us said it, but someone said, you know, why don't we should go to, you know, a developing country and go put solar powered lighting in homes that don't have electricity. And we both just said, yeah, why don't we do that? That could be really cool. And we didn't really have any commitments, no kids or, you know, mortgages or anything like that. So it had kind of come to a standstill. It was prior to the renewal of the investment tax credit. Summer of 2008. So the industry had kind of come to a standstill, and we thought we'd go do some work for 6 months and have something really kind of cool to talk about on our resumes and interviews, and, you know, come back and get jobs in the solar industry. So that's really what it was. And then the more research we did, the more realistic it became.
So that was in 2000.
It was right around July of 2008. I think we launched our website in early August.
Oh, I see.
Like I said, it was right before the renewal of the investment tax credit, and our trip, we left in October of 2008 and returned in December.
Fantastic.
And
right, we're in a new year. So you've touched on how the program works, and you're pleased with what you've seen so far.
Definitely. What's happened is you know, we implemented what we like to call a microfinance light, or sort of a hybrid solution, where we recognized that we didn't have the resources to do a full microfinancing program where we were collecting payments and imposing penalties for people that didn't pay. You know, we just didn't have the on-the-ground resources. So what we did is we instituted a program where they made payments, they made a down payment, essentially, and then they agreed to make monthly payments until the value of the light was paid for. So our partner collects those payments, and then once they've collected all those payments, the village has access to those funds for further development projects. the capital gets almost reinjected into the village.
Now we're not talking about large amounts of large expense in terms of being able to do this. So I understand.
No. I mean each lantern in U.S. dollars is about $25. The idea is, and depending on the situation, we subsidize some of it. Really, what it is that we're removing this kerosene cost, which is a direct cash expense for the villagers. But additionally, there's all these sort of tangential benefits where they can extend their working hours, so you know they don't have to walk 4 or 5 hours a week to the village or to the city, to the little market to buy kerosene. Do some of their domestic activities at night, which can extend their working hours during
like
the day.
Read more.
They can read. Well, the children can study, but a lot of it, a lot of the women commented on, you know, food preparation and just anything that might be done around the house. They started to shift towards nighttime hours, which meant they could work more during the, you know, you and I hear that and we think, well, who wants to work more? But you know, work for them is their livelihood. So to them, they just think, well, that means they can have more rice for the next, you know, food shortage or the next time there's a, you know, some sort of catastrophe, they might have a few extra dollars for an emergency medical fund. So there's all these economic benefits, and essentially when you help them understand this, and our NGO partner, translator and field workers would routinely say, you know, they don't really think in advance. They're a very simple lifestyle, and they don't think about what's going to happen 2 or 3, 4 months from now. They just want to have enough food to eat for the day, and tomorrow's another day. There's not a lot of long-term planning, but when you help them understand that, well, over the course of the next 6 to 9 to 12 months, you can pay for this light by all these avoided costs that you're eliminating. You're eliminating all these costs. And then once the light is paid for, well, now that's just extra money that you have. Our goal is really to, like, prove that this is a feasible model. With the right product, at the right price point, you know, these guys can afford this product.
Well, I would also, you know, it's not necessarily a great idea having kerosene burning in and around the villages and inside, and it's not exactly a sweet smell, you know what I mean?
Exactly. I mean, I sort of touched on the bottom line, what, you know, a lot of lending institutions might care about, but the other benefits, a lot of times you'd go into these little homes or huts, and they'd be burning, they'd be combusting this fuel indoors, so you've got really poor air quality. Every village that we went to reported at least one major burn incident per year. And these little kerosene bottles, they look like a little pint bottle, like a pint bottle of whiskey, if you can kind of imagine that, with a little wick on the top. And it's, you know, they're not on shelves or any tables, they're just on the ground, so they're easily knocked over. Flames can if it's a drier season, flames can, you know, really kind of take over a little home. It can be pretty devastating.
A disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah, so the removing the kerosene is just a great thing. They're able to, some of just the quality of life things. I mean, this year we went in and you know, glass is, you don't really think of this, but glass is not something that's readily available. So many of these little huts and homes don't have, they're dark. We brought a light in, and the guy said, this is the first time that I've seen the inside of my home.
Wow.
So there's a quality of life component that doesn't really figure into the actual economics of it, but when you see it firsthand, it's really sort of amazing how much something so small can be.
Yeah, there was something that I had discovered in talking with Trevor, too, your partner that started this with you, and that was that there are literally, I don't want to hold me on the exact numbers, but I think I'm close to like 1.6 billion people on the planet that don't have access to electricity.
That is the commonly quoted number, and you know, you got to figure that a country like India has over a billion people. If you've ever been to India, it's a very, very populated country, so all of a sudden that number is a little bit more believable, but yeah, it's pretty easy to take what we have for granted.
Now, had you been to India before?
No, our first trip was Beyond Solar's first trip was my first trip to India.
I see. So, what was it like for you that first time?
Well, you know, every single person that I had spoken to before my trip had said along the lines of, "You will be overwhelmed. Every sense is, it's like sensory overload." And it turned out to be quite accurate. I mean, it's a very, very densely populated country, so there's just so many people and there's so many things going on. As soon as you enter into, you know, whatever city you fly into, there's just your eye, you know, the amount of activity you see is just overwhelming. I mean, you have odors that are either incredibly exotic from the spices and the food or incredibly foul because, you know, sometimes they don't have the best, many cities that don't have the infrastructure to handle waste. You know, the touch, it's hot, it's humid, it's sticky, it's you know, the sounds are just everything. It's everything. it's just a fascinating place.
What was the most surprising thing that you have, you know, discovered so far that you, what maybe you didn't expect in relationship to the project or in relationship to just seeing the place? I know you touched on how it felt visually. And
I would say that two things that were just continually surprising, and you know, one I sort of developed, I realized a little bit more in afterthought. But the first thing was that, you know, you kind of have this image of these poor villagers in like a National Geographic type setting. Usually you develop this sort of sense of almost pity. But when I went there, the people were very proud and they seemed generally happy. You know, that they acknowledge problems and things that devastated them, like, you know, a fire in the house could, you know, burn someone and that would be terrible. But it wasn't, the people as a whole seemed like a very, I want to say, content with how they live. And it's almost, they haven't chosen to live a simpler life, you know, it's with their, but I didn't have this sense of, you know, misery that I was a little bit concerned about. So when we offered these lights, they were so, I don't know, grateful and it, you know, they wanted to prove that they were worthy of making these payments and there was an element of pride. You just left with a really good feeling, you know, you left with a feeling that you had a people that were going to really appreciate it. And then the second thing, I guess it kind of follows, is that looking back, I was just kind of amazed at how easy it was to make an impact in these people's lives. I mean, the logistics aside of getting everything organized and planned and shipped, you know, once the lights were there, they really wanted them. And the light is just a simple product. You know, it's not some sort of complex machinery that is going to, you know, transform their lives. It's light.
Right.
And it's something that we just flip the switch every day and never even think about. And it was really sort of amazing how simple the whole process is.
And again, it's my understanding that attached to that light is a small solar panel that's used to power it during the day. Is that right?
Exactly. So the you know, if it were just a flashlight, having to constantly replace with batteries would be obviously cost prohibitive, and they're just not available. So it's a small little solar panel that charges the battery during the day, and you use the light at night, and clean. Simple.
How has the company or the manufacturer that you work with, D-Lite, how have they reacted to the project?
They were really receptive, and that I have to say that made it a lot easier on our end. So they sort of opened the door. They were the ones that put us in touch with the NGOs. When I returned, Trevor had gone home by then. When I returned from the villages, I gave a presentation at D-Lite, and I think I'd been one of the first people that actually had spent an extended amount of time with the villagers, and we lit up a whole village. So they were really proud to be a part of that. They since, you know, we partnered with them, and they have a charitable sort of arm of their organization that allows us to donations, which we've been very, very grateful for. That's been great. I think they have a great product. They've just designed it to meet a need, so We've been really happy.
And what plans do you have at this point for the future of Beyond Solar? And, you know, if listeners want to get involved, how could they do that?
Okay. Well, the greatest thing about our most recent trip is that we've established a framework to distribute these lights. So what I'm looking to do is, you know, SOVA has a lot of ground volunteers, a lot of people in the field. I believe our next deployment I can do without traveling to India. It obviously is a very, it's an added expense, and it's time consuming, and it's my bandwidth is somewhat limited at times. So what I'd like to do is we're gonna start, you know, doing a little bit more of a formal fundraising campaign, maybe to organizations, foundations, corporate charities, corporate sponsored charities. And ideally, we'd like to blanket that region with solar powered lighting. I mean, there's up to 1,000 villagers that need these lights, and I think we can do that in the next few years. Ideally, we would be able to establish that as sort of an ongoing program. I was actually just this evening speaking with a woman who works for a solar company out of South Africa. So, and I've been approached by a few other people that have just heard about it. So I'm looking to sort of reach out and see if the model that we developed in India can apply elsewhere. Obviously, it will have to be tweaked and modified, but I would love to reach out to a new region. You know, I, the end goal would be that Beyond Solar has worked in, you know, numerous regions with perhaps numerous different technologies and really can be a resource for people that want to do large, scalable projects. As far as people wanting to help out, we're a nonprofit organization, so, you know, really fundraising is really the number one driver of whether or not we'll be, you know, where we can take our projects. Getting our name out, people hearing about us through random channels and dropping us $25, you know, sometimes that's the donation that's most appreciated, because you know that it's not really based on, you know, it's not a relative or a friend, it's someone that just heard about it and had no real tie to Beyond Solar, yet still felt the need or the willingness to donate.
And you're also on the web as well, as I understand. I'm sorry.
Yes, we are at beyondsolar.org. Yeah, there's been a lot of interest. At least once a week, I'll field a call or an email from someone that heard about us from someone else. So it's great that we've been, our name's been out there. I need to do a little bit of, you know, office cleaning and back office work after this most recent trip and document that and publicize it a little more and hopefully get our name out there even more through podcasts such as this.
Good. Well, is there anything else you'd like to share at this point?
You know, a lot of people, and Trevor and I made this mistake, I wouldn't say mistake, but when we initially started, we thought that we needed to go big to make an impact. And I think the thing that surprised us the most is that when you're starting with someone who has so little, just by providing them a basic amenity such as light, you know, the change is just so drastic. You don't need to go in and do a multi-thousand dollar installation of solar panels so they can have fans. And, you know, to people that don't have light, any source of light is great. So I think the thing that, again, it almost surprises us is just how small and simple these solutions are, yet how effective they are at affecting change in these people's lives.
Well, Jeff, I want to say thanks. Thank you, and thanks to Trevor for showing us how, you know, Beyond Solar is piecing together the puzzles of our new green economy, both locally and globally. And thanks for joining us on this edition of In the Mix.
When you hear that sound.